Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org. This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. It's time for the news roundup. COVID-19 cases continue to increase as the Delta variant spreads across America. According to data from Johns Hopkins, new cases have gone up 180% over the last 2 weeks. On Thursday, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky warned we're at another pivotal point in the pandemic.
Compared to the virus we had circulating initially in the United States at the start of the pandemic, the Delta variant is more aggressive and much more transmissible than previously circulating strains. It is one of the most infectious respiratory viruses we know of and that I have seen in my 20-year career.
Meanwhile, efforts to move both an infrastructure bill and a January 6th task force stumble in Congress. And for the first time in 50 years, the Milwaukee Bucks walk away with the NBA championship. Joining us now is Eva McKend. She's a congressional correspondent with Spectrum News. Eva, welcome.
Good to be with you, Jen.
Also with us, Phil Mattingly, a senior White House correspondent with CNN. Phil, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Jen.
And also with CNN, Maggie Fox. She's a senior health editor. Maggie, it's always great to have you on.
Always a pleasure, Jen.
So let's start with COVID, Maggie. Right now, the Delta variant makes up more than 80% of all new cases in the U.S. How much is the surge about the variant, and how much of it is about relaxing some of the standards we've been following for the past year?
Well, it's hard to know. It does look like the variant's very much more transmissible, but you can only know what you study. And people have, as you say, started loosening up. They're moving around more. They're going back to school. They're sending their kids to summer camp. They're going to restaurants and bars. So it's kind of hard to know. But you've got the combination of this more transmissible virus, people moving around more, and a considerable proportion of the population still unvaccinated and still refusing to wear masks as well.
Well, right now, case numbers still aren't near their winter peak. Could we find ourselves in that place again?
It's possible. I mean, we know respiratory viruses pick up again in the fall as people move inside and gather more indoors and start doing the things that happen in the fall, like go back to school. And you've got large movements of people across the country as college students go from one place to another to go back to school and people return from summer vacation. So, yes, researchers say it's entirely possible that we could have another big surge.
Walensky was also asked about whether the CDC would alter its mask guidance. Remind us, what's the current guidance, and could we see it change?
Well, the current guidance is if you're vaccinated, you don't need a mask under most circumstances, whether you're around unvaccinated people or other vaccinated people. The exceptions are if you're traveling, if you're on public transport of any kind, on an airplane, international travel, then you're supposed to wear a mask. And the criticism is that we don't know if vaccinated people are more vulnerable if they are surrounded by a bunch of unvaccinated people and a lot of circulating virus. And there's also a little bit of doubt about whether if you happen to be vaccinated and get an asymptomatic infection, whether with the Delta variant, you might be more likely to pass it on to somebody else. So there's a lot of talk about changing that guidance. Some of the criticism also says that when the CDC said this, they kind of gave a free-for-all signal to the whole country to just take off the masks everywhere. And even unvaccinated people kind of got the message that they really didn't need to wear masks and that it created confusion for that reason.
Eva, a handful of Republicans in Congress held a press conference on Thursday to promote vaccinations among their constituents. What's happening right now with the GOP and vaccine messaging?
Well, these are doctors that held that press conference to basically talk about the significance of getting vaccinated. We're also hearing this consistently from Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Both this week and last week, he led his news conference, his weekly news conference, talking about the importance of taking the vaccine and his experience as a polio survivor. But, you know, I pushed back against this last week, and I said, because he often says that this is perplexing that more people are not taking the vaccine. And I said, respectfully, Leader McConnell, it isn't all that perplexing when there are Republicans in Congress and in the conservative media posing questions about the casting doubt on the vaccine under the guise of posing questions about it. And he said that he just speaks for himself and he will continue to do so. But I think that Republicans, as we see the Delta variant emerge and spread, I think they are feeling pressure on this issue and how it is impacting their communities.
At the same time, we should note that that conference did include some vaccine promotion, but most of it involved promoting the unfounded theory that COVID was made in a lab and Democrats knew about it. What political line are Republicans trying to walk right now?
Yeah, I mean, that is, I think, you know, those are legitimate questions, but I think some are asking, is this the right time to have them? We do not know the origins of the virus, and that is something that a lot of people want more information about, are suspicious if China will ever allow America to do the investigation that needs to be done. But aside from that, you know, this is a public health crisis in our country right now. And so many are asking, why is there so much emphasis on this question about the origins of the virus and not more attention to making sure that as many people as possible get vaccinated?
Well, speaking of Republicans and COVID, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis also urged his constituents to get the vaccine this week.
If you are vaccinated, fully vaccinated, the chance of you getting seriously ill or dying from COVID is effectively zero. If you look at the people that are being admitted to hospitals, over 95% of them are either not fully vaccinated or not vaccinated at all. And so these vaccines are saving lives. They are reducing mortality.
Now, Maggie, right now, Florida is averaging the most new cases of any state at roughly 6,000 a day. What's happening in Florida and what do these new cases mean on the ground?
Well, I mean, it means hospitals are starting to fill up. It's not as bad in Florida yet as it has been in, say, southwest Missouri, where some of the hospitals there were overwhelmed. But as you get more cases, you'll get more cases, of course. This is an infectious disease. So the more infected people you have, the more other people they're going to infect, especially since, as we know, unvaccinated people are more vulnerable. And Florida is one of those states that has a lot of unvaccinated people. So those hospitals are preparing for another surge of patients.
Well, a new poll from Axios and Ipsos shows that at this point, most unvaccinated Americans won't get the shot for any reason. It doesn't matter who the messaging comes from. So how helpful are these statements from DeSantis and others in the GOP in changing the minds of the vaccine hesitant?
Well, people will tell a poll one thing and they'll often act in another way. And vaccines is a place where people are really squishy and will say something very firmly and then change their behavior. It certainly will not hurt to have GOP leaders saying, get the vaccine, because this has become such a political issue. And if we can try to get people to depoliticize it, that may help some people think, okay, it's not that I'm on the Republican team and Republicans don't get vaccinated. That's not the issue here. I also think that as more people get vaccinated and we have more evidence of the safety of the vaccines, people will start to change their minds as well. And it's well known that people pretty much follow the lead of their friends, their neighbors, their family members. So if a few people can move the needle a little bit, it will start to move things a bit more. But it does look like it's going to be a long haul in this country to get the majority of people vaccinated.
Phil, the White House dealt with its own small COVID outbreak this week. What happened there?
I think reality, right? It's a little bit of what we've been seeing around the country kind of came to the doorstep of President Biden's administration. We actually saw it on Capitol Hill as well. We've seen it a number of times where you've seen breakthrough cases, individuals that are fully vaccinated. They are not going to the hospital. They're certainly not in danger of dying, but they are having mild symptoms in both of the cases. One, a senior advisor in Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office on Capitol Hill, but also a White House staffer as well. They kind of went through their normal protocols. Those protocols actually have not changed at all. We're still maskless in the White House right now. And, you know, White House officials still get tested on a fairly regular basis instead of reporters that are in the pool. But I think what it underscored, you know, you talk to White House officials about it and they say a couple things. They said, look, we understood that this was possible and it was very likely to happen. There are hundreds of people that work in the West Wing on a regular basis. While the vast majority of them, they believe, are vaccinated, breakthrough cases are a thing. And the other thing they try and point to is the efficacy of the vaccine. The symptoms for the individual at the White House had been mild. They believe that demonstrates that things work. So, but I think this is just something that, you know, when you talk to White House officials, particularly over the course of the last couple of weeks, there's a recognition both on the national level, but also on a very micro kind of in their own office and workspace level, that this is something that maybe a couple weeks ago, a couple months ago, people thought was starting to dissipate on a pretty to a pretty large degree. And maybe now that was a little short-sighted.
Well, and Maggie, just explain a bit about how breakthrough infections work, because some vaccine skeptics are pointing to them as evidence that the vaccines don't work.
Well, it's silly to say that the vaccines don't work. Of course, the vaccine doesn't create a glass plate between you and everybody else. It doesn't stop the virus from getting into your body. What they stop the virus from doing is taking hold and replicating and spreading in your body. And there are varying degrees of immune responses. Some people respond better to the vaccine than others do.
We're rounding up the week's top stories. Ajax on Twitter says, the CDC said people that are unvaccinated could unmask. Huge mistake. There's no way to tell the vaccinated from unvaccinated, and all mandates have been lifted. There's no getting people to go back now. We'll have more in just a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Audible. Chasing Ghislaine is a new investigative podcast series from executive producer James Patterson and hosted by veteran journalist Vicky Ward, who has been covering the Jeffrey Epstein saga for nearly 20 years. Epstein's story intertwines with the disgraced heiress Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's ex-lover, former employee, and alleged co-conspirator. Chasing Ghislaine is available exclusively on Audible. To start listening, go to audible.com/chasing.
Investigations into police use of force and misconduct were secret in California until now. We've sifted through hours of interrogation tape to find out who does the system of police accountability really serve and who does it protect. Listen now to every episode of the new podcast On Our Watch from NPR and KQED.
You're listening to the News Roundup. Let's get back to the conversation with this message. We got this question from Ernie on Twitter, who says, is there any update on the progress of making the COVID vaccine available to children under 12? Maggie, any updates there?
Well, the companies are looking at what they need to do, what kind of data they need to present to the FDA. For kids under 12, it's a lot more sensitive. People want a lot more safety information. They want a lot more dosing information. Do younger kids maybe need a little less vaccine? So that's all still being prepared. The FDA says it's ready to hear submissions from companies, but I wouldn't expect anything before the end of the year and maybe the beginning of next year for that, because people just want a lot more information with younger kids.
Well, this week, President Biden took questions from voters at a town hall in Ohio. Biden talked about infrastructure, the economy, and voting rights. He also, of course, spoke about COVID-19, and not everyone was thrilled with his commentary. Dr. Lena Wen later told CNN his answers about the vaccines were well-intentioned but inaccurate.
I was actually disappointed by President Biden's speech tonight, or his answers tonight, because I actually thought that he was answering questions as if it were a month ago. He's not really meeting the realities of what's happening on the ground. I mean, we now have triple the number of infections in the U.S. versus a month ago. We have escalation in cases all over the country because of the Delta variant. And we actually don't know the answers to a lot of questions. He was talking about how if you get the vaccine, you're well protected from having severe disease. That's true. But we actually don't know how well you're protected from mild illness and whether with the Delta variant, if you're vaccinated, could you still be contagious to other people?
Maggie, what is the main disagreement here?
Well, you know, President Biden speaks very imprecisely, he speaks very casually, even in formal settings where you would expect him to pick his words more carefully. That's not his style. And he's speaking very broadly. So he says, oh, you're not going to get infected. People talk like that. He wasn't being precise the way a scientist or a doctor would be and say, your odds of being infected are very much lower. And Dr. Nguyen's point is that he is speaking to the country and people are listening to him, and he needs to be a bit more precise. And it's true, we're in a time now of a little more uncertainty than we were a couple of months ago, when it looked like the vaccines protect really, really well, and there wasn't much spread of the virus. Now there's a lot more spread. We have this new variant that appears to be more transmissible. We don't really know how much more transmissible, and we really don't know if vaccinated people have a different level of risk to themselves and others than before this variant became the dominant variant.
So we're still learning. Phil, what does this say about the tone the White House is trying to strike when it comes to COVID-19?
I think it underscores the difficulty, right? I think the White House was very all in. They were surprised when the CDC changed their mask guidance a couple months ago. It seems like time is all blends together at this point over the course of the last year or two. And they have been, you know, first out of the gate to make clear the really significant progress they've made in vaccinations and distribution kind of across the board over the course of their first 6 months in office. But the reality is this is still an issue, and it is a growing issue, a growing problem, one I think a lot of White House officials thought they were just at the brink of putting behind them. It is very clear now they are not putting it behind them right now. And I think there's a new urgency when you talk to White House officials, recognizing that we're not closing the door on this. We're not turning the page on this. This is very much still with us. It's very much still a problem. And we need to figure out a way to address this. Now, they've never stopped pushing for vaccinations. They're obviously in a very different, I think, kind of phase of how they push that process, you know, more of a grinded out one dose by one dose phase than kind of the mass vaccinations we saw a few months ago. But there is a clear recognition, and I think a clear shift, both tonally, but I think when you talk to individuals behind the scenes as well, that this was, COVID was maybe starting to move a little bit down the line in terms of priorities, in terms of things that they wanted to be focused on over the course of the next couple of months. And it is now steadily going back to the top. And I think there's a recognition that this isn't going anywhere anytime soon. I think everybody always kind of knew that, but the numbers and everything they've seen with Delta over the course of the last couple of weeks have really hammered that home.
So what does that mean about the White House strategy? Might we see a pivot? Because there's this, these sort of dueling narratives of you can return to life as normal if you're vaccinated, but there seems to be a lot of confusion about masks. And as Maggie said, we're still learning about how well protected vaccinated people are against the Delta variant. So what's the White House approach here?
It's complicated, you know, and I know Maggie knows this better than anybody, but in the conversations that I've had, you know, you have to, this White House has made very clear, obviously since the campaign, but also since the president walked into the Oval Office on January 20th, that they were going to lead with science. He was going to listen to his scientists. His scientists were going to dictate the posture and policy of the administration. But there's a lot of politics here as well. There's a lot of recognition of people being exhausted in the country in terms of mandates or what you can try and impose from a protection standpoint, both on the federal level, but also on the state and local level. And so I think all of those elements the administration is cognizant of as they start to have these conversations again at kind of a faster clip. Are they going to dramatically change their posture compared to the last several weeks? No, I don't think that's really in the cards right now. But I do think that there are definitely conversations ongoing, both from White House officials, public health officials, CDC officials, about, given what we've seen over the course of the last several weeks, do changes in overall guidance, not mandates, not significant policy changes, but guidance, does that type of thing need to shift, or do they need to be have some more nuance in terms of how things are approached? All of those things are on the table right now. My sense of things is that they aren't anywhere near some type of outcome or policy conclusion yet, but it's all a recognition that Delta is a significant problem. It is moving very fast. And there's a possibility right now that things were taken off the table, or things were considered to be okay maybe a little bit sooner than they should have been.
Well, Maggie, and I just want to be really clear about what we do know about vaccination and the Delta variant. What's the latest?
There's not any latest, and that's one of the problems. The CDC's not collecting data on asymptomatic cases or on mild cases. We're still not doing nearly enough testing in this country to really know how many vaccinated people have a mild infection. What the CDC is tracking is people who are hospitalized or people who die, and that's easy to do because it's a reportable disease, and they get that data, and it's very easy to see someone who's sick enough to be hospitalized. What's not easy to see is someone who might have it and feel perfectly fine, or somebody who feels a little under the weather or a little headachy, and they don't know whether they have it. We don't know. There's a lot of conflicting data coming in now. Just this week, the DC reported that it had a very low level of breakthrough infections among people who had been vaccinated. But DC also revealed that only 16% of cases in the district are attributable to the Delta variant. So that's interesting. On the other side of things, in LA, it looks like a lot more cases are attributable to the Delta variant, and there might be more breakthroughs. We had a report from Houston Methodist Hospital yesterday where they found that people who had been vaccinated and then exposed to the Delta variant were more likely to have breakthrough infections. But these are just little piecemeal pieces of information. We don't have a good picture across the country of what happens. We've caught these cases in the White House because people are tested regularly there. So if you do get one of these transient infections, it's going to be caught. Most people don't get tested after they've been vaccinated.
Well, it seems to point to a larger issue we've been talking about over the course of the pandemic, and that's just a lack of contact tracing in the U.S. We don't know or don't have enough data about how the virus has been spreading. Is that accurate?
That's true. We don't. Most places are not even attempting to do any contact tracing at all. And what you need for contact tracing is regular testing of people so you can catch the cases early. And then you have to talk to those people and find out where they've been and who they've been in contact with and track down those people. It takes a lot of effort, and the U.S. never tried. There's been places in the U.S. San Francisco had a concerted contact tracing effort that looked like it was very successful. Massachusetts has been doing it. There have been some communities across the U.S. that have been doing it, but as a whole, this country's not doing it, and they're not taking the first step, which is more widespread testing. Now, the Biden administration has put more money and more effort into that this week, but again, not nearly enough to even have any kind of picture of what's going on.
Well, during a Senate hearing on Tuesday, Republican Senator Rand Paul and Dr. Anthony Fauci exchanged some heated words again.
Those viruses are molecularly impossible
no one's
to result
they are. No
in SARS-CoV-2.
Those viruses caused the pandemic.
Paul,
we're saying they are gain-of-function viruses because they were animal
not.
Viruses that became more transmissible in human, and you funded it.
And you
admit the truth.
And you implying...
Senator Paul, your time has expired, and I will allow witnesses who come before this committee to respond.
And you are implying that what we did was responsible for the deaths of individual. I totally resent that. And if anybody is lying here, Senator, it is you.
Now, Maggie, this exchange was seemingly about gain-of-function viruses. Give us some context here.
Okay, this is a very arcane area of research, and Rand Paul knows it, and he's exploiting people's lack of knowledge about how this works. Gain-of-function research is a type of experiment that you work with viruses. It's a natural question to ask. If you've got something like COVID-19, what would it take for this virus to get worse? What would it take for something like a chicken flu to become transmissible to humans? And there are researchers who do this in the lab. It's like, okay, if we change this genetic sequence, does it make it more transmissible? If we take this genetic sequence, does it make it easier to pass from chickens to humans? It's called gain-of-function research. It's a little bit controversial because of widespread fears that this, you could create a Frankenstein virus that would spread from the lab. This is what they're talking about. And Rand Paul is saying that the Wuhan Institute of Virology in Hunan, China, was doing this research and that U.S. money was paying for it. It's It's been asked and answered, and it's pretty clear that National Institutes of Health funding did not go directly to the Wuhan Institute of Virology to pay for gain-of-function research. But the bigger issue is that what Rand Paul's trying to do is put doubt in people's minds that, oh, maybe there was this bad research going on at this lab in China. Maybe it did leak out. Maybe it did cause the pandemic. And maybe the U.S. federal government is responsible for it. And he's really taking a bunch of big leaps. He's throwing out a lot of innuendo. And again, these are questions that have been asked and answered. And no, that is not what happened.
Eva, why keep beating this drum?
Well, because, you know, he enjoys this conflict. You know, right afterwards, he runs to conservative media. He gets applauded every time that these showdowns occur. He gets a rise out of Dr. Fauci. The clash, though, does stem from a larger concern. It's been 18 months since the start of the pandemic, and we still don't have a clear understanding of the origins of the virus. And so Senator Paul is playing into those concerns. There will be plenty of time to examine the role of the NIH, who they collaborate with, where the money goes. But in Senator Paul's own state, less than 50% of all Kentuckians are vaccinated. Where is that same passion and fervor and concern that he shows in these exchanges with Dr. Fauci for the people in his state that are still not vaccinated? And he himself as well has not been vaccinated. He argues that he has natural immunity.
Well, Twitter has temporarily banned Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene for misinformation on the COVID-19 vaccine. Phil, what was the reason for her suspension?
It tracks. It was a shorter term suspension, but it tracks with what we've seen, I think, really kind of repeatedly over the course of the last several weeks and to some degree several months, where, you know, you start to you've had some members. They generally are the same members over and over at this point in time that start to, you know, raise questions or make specific statements that are very clearly untrue as it relates to these things. And Twitter takes action, or one of the social media takes action. And then we see kind of the same effect down the line, which kind of gets to what Eva was talking about with Senator Paul post-hearing, which is then they raise money off of it, then they become martyrs because of it, and then we kind of rinse, repeat, and go over and over again. And I think it's, you know, not to bring this into a broader debate about social media platforms and misinformation, though that has become a huge issue in Washington over the course of the last 10 days or 15 days. It underscores the difficulty kind of surrounding this entire issue across the board. You know, it's not just whether or not people believe conspiracy theories, or whether or not people are willing to, believe the worst about vaccines or some thread that they've seen on Facebook. It's that there's also kind of perverse incentives from lawmakers, from people who actually have power to push these issues, to tout these issues. There's fundraising elements of it. There's popularity elements. There's virality elements on social media. That kind of all goes into this kind of toxic brew, I guess, if you will. And we've just seen it play out repeatedly, and I don't think it's going to change anytime soon, unfortunately.
Here's a comment we got from Arnold. Hopefully, the sociology of clusters and links will be more widespread, and a more sophisticated policy can be in place for the next pandemic. It was a mistake to only focus on data and the science. Advertising professionals would have crafted a more effective message. I mean, Maggie, I'm wondering about some of the conversations you're hearing about messaging, especially we're in the time of social media and this really difficult effort to push back on mis and disinformation.
Well, it's really hard. I mean, this stuff is hard to understand, this whole issue of where did the virus come from. You know, you can say broadly, we don't know. That makes it sound like it could be almost anything. And in fact, we do know. Scientists who study this understand very well that the origins of the virus are almost certainly natural. It's almost certainly an animal and passed to people. And it happens all the time. That's where flu comes from. All the new flus come from animals to people, too. That's well known. But you have to have studied this for many, many years to understand it. Social media tends to boil everything down to a single line. We don't know. It's a mystery. It could have come from here. And people, of course, are attracted to what's easy, what's easy to understand, what's easy to grasp. The CDC, the federal government, the Health and Human Services Department have known for 20 years that a pandemic is coming and that the worst one you could expect would look like this. They've been studying messaging. They have been trying to figure out how you talk to people when it does come. Social media and the politicization of this country has blown that up at literally the worst time it could happen. The pandemic struck just as the whole way of messaging to the United States got messed up.
A quick sports update. The Cleveland baseball team has a new name. The club has announced on social media that it will now be known as the Cleveland Guardians. That starts in 2022. We'll hear more from you and our guests in just a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
You're listening to the News Roundup. Now let's get back to the conversation. Well, this week, a group of state attorneys general announced they'd reached a $26 billion settlement to combat the opioid epidemic. The deal was struck with the nation's three largest opioid makers and pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson. The four companies have been accused of fueling the opioid epidemic and downplaying the addiction risk. Maggie, briefly tell us more about this deal. What does it involve?
Well, I mean, these deals are meant to repay the states for everything they have spent in fighting the opioid epidemic crisis. It costs Medicaid a huge amount of money to treat people, and the states are on the hook for most of that. But of course, the bigger problem is that these companies had figured out that these are really popular drugs, and they have pushed them hard. They've pushed them hard as safe, as effective. And, you know, just try going to any doctor with any kind of pain and talk them out of prescribing you an opioid. They're very effective, and people ask for them. So the argument is that the companies have exploited this and knew good and well just how addictive these drugs were and what opioid use could lead to, and marketed these drugs anyway. We've seen the effects. The opioid deaths are spiraling through the roof. The pandemic made it even worse. We had a 30% increase in drug overdose deaths in 2020. People take these pills once or twice and can very quickly become addicted to them. Not everyone, but there's a significant proportion of the population who will become addicted to these drugs with a very small exposure to them.
Now, we should say that every state is not on board. West Virginia's attorney general announced he's rejecting the deal, along with Washington State's attorney general. So what happens next?
Well, if you're not in on the deal, then you've got to negotiate your own settlement. These things drag out for years and years, but the states are obviously looking for the deep pockets of these companies to reimburse them even more. And it does cost states a lot. These companies are going to end up having to pay a lot of money to make up for this damage.
That's Maggie Fox. She's a senior health editor with CNN. Maggie, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Let's turn back to politics. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has rejected two of House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy's picks for the committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection. At issue are Republican Congressmen Jim Banks and Jim Jordan. Now, McCarthy says he will withdraw all of his selections if Pelosi doesn't rescind her rejection. Pelosi says that's not going to happen.
These people are going to act up, cause a problem. And people said to me, put them on, and then when they act up, you can take them off. I said, why should we waste time on something as predictable? The Republicans that they put on will have their own point of view. Nobody's saying that it all should be one point of view going on the committee. But it is when statements are ridiculous and fall into the realm of you must be kidding. There's no way that they're going to be on the committee.
Eva, explain a bit more about Banks and Jordan and the concerns we're hearing there.
Well, Speaker Pelosi has always said that she is principally focused with maintaining the integrity of the investigation. And she believes that these two members of Congress, specifically with the statements that they came out after they were named by Leader McCarthy, that they would not take this investigation seriously. I do wonder if they had said nothing, if they had said, you know, thank you, Leader McCarthy, for trusting us for this role and position. I wonder if they would have said nothing, if she would have still done this. They've made statements in the past casting doubt on this type of investigation. But had they had been quiet, I wonder if this would have gone a different way. Nevertheless, it didn't. And this is where we are now. I think what is noteworthy about this is that it does feel very personal between Speaker Pelosi and Leader McCarthy. He said, why are you allowing a lame duck speaker to destroy this institution? He asked that of Democrats in Congress. That's a pretty bold pronouncement on his part. It's clear that he is itching for the gavel. He's so close he can almost taste the speakership. But Democrats narrowly held on to the majority in November. So that was a pretty personal attack to characterize Speaker Pelosi as a lame duck speaker. He has said that Republicans will pursue their own January 6th investigation. And he's standing firm in that, saying that because these two members, since Speaker Pelosi has said that they cannot participate, no Republicans will participate. Of course, Liz Cheney, Speaker Pelosi did name Liz Cheney as part of this panel. So she will be one of the Republicans for now. And she could name more Republicans. We'll have to wait and see.
Well, we should mention here that Banks and Jordan are two of the 139 Republicans who voted to overturn the election results. But let's hear right now from Liz Cheney.
At every opportunity, the minority leader has attempted to prevent the American people from understanding what happened, to block this investigation.
Again, that's Republican Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney weighing in on McCarthy's decision there. Phil, what would it mean for the investigation if McCarthy follows through on this threat to pull all of his committee picks?
You know, I don't actually think it changes kind of the scope and path of the overall investigation, right? Obviously, the speaker's appointed her members. As Eva mentioned, it's pretty likely that there will be at least one, if not two, other Republican appointees by the speaker over the course of the next couple of days. Congressman Adam Kinzinger is being under consideration, we're being told. Also, Denver Riggleman, who is a former congressman, former Republican congressman, is also somebody that Democrats have been discussing potentially adding. So it's moving forward, whether Leader McCarthy's members are on it or not. And I think that regardless of whether or not they were on it, Democrats and Benny Thompson, who's the chair of the committee, had a pretty clear idea of where he wanted things to go and kind of the process that he wanted to play out. And I don't think whether or not Jim Banks or Jim Jordan or anybody else is on the committee is going to change that. I think the biggest question, and this is very Washington, and I understand people's frustration with it, it's just kind of the optics around it, right? How is it perceived when a final report comes out or when a hearing is being held? There's a hearing just next week is the first hearing. And if there's no Republican selections on the dais, no Republican selections asking questions of witnesses, does that undercut what they're actually going for in the mind of those who are watching it? I don't think at this point in time, if somebody thought this committee was a sham to begin with, nothing was going to change if Jim Jordan was on that committee versus if he's not. If somebody believed that this committee was the only way to do this investigation, that view is not going to be changed by whether or not Kevin McCarthy's members of his conference are on the committee or not. So I think everything kind of just stays in a straight line. I just think the politics and kind of the messaging around it just gets amped up to a degree I think we all probably expected it to end up at, maybe just a few weeks or months earlier than we expected it to be there.
Well, this week, the Congressional Budget Office told the Treasury Department that it would likely run out of cash in October or November if Congress doesn't raise the debt ceiling. On Wednesday, Senate Republicans threatened to vote against the debt ceiling increase if Congress doesn't first agree to spending cutbacks. Phil, how likely is it that Senate Republicans will be appeased here?
Man, this is a great question. Jen, I'll tell you, this has been an issue that I've been kind of tangentially working on for the last several weeks now. You know, we've all covered this stuff enough to know that the debt ceiling has been, you know, a self-imposed crisis that lawmakers and administrations have put on themselves for the better part of the last 6 or 7 years. And this one just felt like it was like quietly creeping up. You know, obviously the Biden administration is very focused on their agenda. You know, so are congressional Democrats. Republicans are kind of doing their thing as well. And no one's really talking about the fact that this deadline was about to hit. The suspension of the debt ceiling ends next week, and then the Treasury Department can do extraordinary measures to get to, as the CBO was saying, kind of early fall time period. Leader McConnell put down a marker, and about as strong a marker as you can put down. And this is something we've seen over the course of the last several administrations, where the minority tends to say, all right, this is your guys' job. You go ahead and handle this. And then if it's Republicans, then the next time Democrats are in the minority, they kind of take a similar tact on things. Here's the reality. You cannot mess around with the debt ceiling. This is something that has to be done. And in the U.S. Senate, that means it's going to take 60 votes, most likely. Right now, Democrats are looking at several vehicles to be able to move an increase. You know, one of those vehicles might be, you know, the budget reconciliation package that only requires a simple majority to move through. I won't wander us down that rabbit hole right now, but I will say that, you know, most likely you are going to need Republican votes. All this underscores right now is this is going to be a very, very significant fight, because I've not talked to a single Democrat either on Capitol Hill or in the White House who is willing to negotiate on this issue, is willing to give anything to Republicans in order to have their support on this. So once again, we are going to move into a very, very dicey territory for the U.S. economy, for the full faith and credit of the U.S. government on a debt ceiling issue, as we've done several times, rather stupidly over the course of the last 6 or 7 years.
Eva, and just in plain terms, if a deal isn't reached, if the debt ceiling isn't raised in time, what happens?
So this is complicated fiscal policy, but my understanding is that they then only have a few months, like until September, October. But it is, I think ultimately it will be raised, or Senator McConnell suggested that Senate Democrats, if they don't agree to decrease spending, that Democrats should include it in their $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation package. So that's potentially another vehicle for which it can be raised. But Congress has a lot on their plate, and now they have this as well. If the infrastructure package wasn't enough, police reform negotiations, somehow they also have to figure out how to address this issue as well.
Well, another item on their plate is this infrastructure bill. On Wednesday, Senate Republicans blocked a vote to begin debating a bipartisan infrastructure bill worth $1.2 trillion. Lawmakers said they plan to advance the measure by early next week. And Phil, we should be clear, there's the partisan infrastructure package, and then there's the bipartisan infrastructure package. And this is the bipartisan one. So why are Republicans throwing up roadblocks?
Because they want the negotiations to continue. It seems strange and very counterintuitive, but welcome to the United States Senate, which lives in that space on a daily basis. So look, these negotiations have actually been, they've been slow, but it's the United States Congress. It's kind of how they roll. But they've been making a lot of progress for a group of Republicans and Democrats who had already signed off with the agreement of the president on a framework. There were a number of outstanding issues. You know, this is the reality. Agreeing to a framework is the easiest thing to do in Washington. Turning that framework into actual legislative text, turning that framework into actual policy, is actually very, very hard. And that's what they've been in the process doing over the course of the last several weeks. They were not done with that process yet. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer wanted to kind of put his foot on the gas a little bit, maybe light a fire under them. And so he said, I'm going to file cloture, we're going to have a procedural vote, and we're going to start the process. Doesn't mean that they're voting on specific amendments. Doesn't mean they're voting on a bill that doesn't exist yet. Just that they're going to start the process. And Republicans basically said, we're not going to let you jam us on this one. And so they sank the procedural vote. It meant absolutely nothing in the grand scheme of things, other than they wanted to keep negotiating. And it's worth noting, the White House was okay with that. Schumer was okay with the fact that Democrats and Republicans were going to keep negotiating. The reality is that they need to speed this up from the White House and Democratic perspective. And so Schumer was just trying to kind of push that along. I think it served its purpose. They certainly got a lot more done over the course of the 3 days leading up to that failed vote than they probably would have without it sitting out there. There's still a couple of issues that they need to wrap up. They want to try and start the process early on Monday or Tuesday. One just final point I'd make, you know, there's a lot of progressives who aren't huge fans of this deal. There's a lot of Democrats that say, please stop wasting time negotiating with Republicans. This bipartisan proposal, not the second $3.5 trillion proposal, this proposal is the linchpin to Biden's entire agenda. If this moves, that second proposal has a pathway. If this falls apart, so does Biden's entire agenda. So does the Democratic agenda on Capitol Hill in its entirety. That's why this is so important. That's why they're still talking. And that's why Biden is so, President Biden is so so deeply, deeply engaged on trying to get this over the finish line.
So, and also, Eva, how much of a political test? So there's the agenda, the Biden agenda, but then there's also the test about whether or not Congress can function at all right now. Is that also in play here?
It's a critical question. And I think that is why Senator Schumer called for this procedural vote this week, to remind everybody that he could. That he could call the vote at any time and to increase the pressure on Republicans and Democrats who are invested in seeing this bipartisan infrastructure move forward. But this is a big test. This is a big test for the administration. This is a big test for members of Congress. And, you know, we will see what happens next week when the vote happens again. But it will be a crushing state of affairs for all of the people that have worked so hard if this bipartisan infrastructure package doesn't move forward. And I think politically it's going to hurt both sides as well. If after all of these months of negotiations, people are not seeing investments in roads, bridges, rural communities, not seeing investments in broadband back home.
Phil, I'll give you the last word here about the politics side of this.
Here's the reality. The president campaigned on this. The president wants this. It's not just the politics. It's the policy as well that aligns for this to be the moment where they can actually get something done on a bipartisan basis. It's politically advantageous for both sides. There's still a lot of questions. Policy is difficult to put into place, particularly when politics are working against it. That is an element here as well to keep an eye on. But right now, things are still somewhat moving in the right direction.
That's Phil Mattingly. He's a senior White House correspondent with CNN. Also with us, Eva McKend, a congressional correspondent with Spectrum News. Eva, Phil, thanks. 1A's lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. And Chris Castano is our digital editor. You're listening to the News Roundup. We'll discuss the week's biggest headlines from around the world in just a moment. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
We're rounding up the week's biggest headlines from around the globe. It's the international edition of the News Roundup. We've been watching a splendid display from the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games in Tokyo. It's a true cornucopia of countries, just like the Global News Roundup. For the next hour, we'll go around the world and take in some of its biggest stories. On the agenda, we have a spot of spyware, a spike of COVID, and a special invitation to the White House from President Biden to one world leader who played a big part in our own politics last year. Our guests this week are Nina Maria Potts, Director of Global News Coverage for Feature Story News. Nina Maria, it's always great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Nick Schifrin, a foreign affairs and defense correspondent with the PBS NewsHour. Nick, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And from the BBC, Paul Danahar. Paul is the BBC's Washington Bureau Chief and author of The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. Paul, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Well, deadly floods are upending lives from China to Germany to Nigeria. At least 25 people in the central Chinese province of Henan died on Tuesday. That included a dozen trapped in a city subway as the waters rose. And it comes a week after floods killed at least 160 in Germany and 31 in Belgium. Speaking in London this week, U.S. climate envoy John Kerry said China must cut emissions sooner if the planet is to avoid climate chaos.
It is not a mystery that China and the U.S. have many differences. But on climate cooperation, it is the only way to break free from the world's current mutual suicide pact.
Nina, before we get into the specifics, as someone with a global overview on what stories are making the biggest headlines, how much attention is climate change getting right now?
Well, I guess just to start in China, in Zhengzhou, which, by the way, is home to the world's largest iPhone production facility, what was very striking about the reaction to the Henan floods in China was that just after Germany's floods, nationalists in China sort of leapt on social media to denounce the German flood response, saying that this was another example of the failings of crumbling democracies, mocking the West, insisting that if something like that ever happened in China, the response would have been immediate. And then suddenly something similar did happen in China. And China's playbook is always the same when it comes to this sort of disaster, playing up the heroes, but in stark contrast to Germany, where the floods prompted almost immediately a big debate about climate change. Instead, in China, in the early stages of propaganda, the state media was saying, why did so much rain fall in a single day? Basically blaming the exceptional weather. Couldn't therefore possibly be anyone's fault. Later, there was a backlash against weather forecasters, but China's narrative is very often the same. Play up the heroes, praised for the militaristic operation to save lives, but very rarely prompting any real debate about climate change. And this is to your point. We're seeing some anger leveled against the state media in China about downplaying the extent of the flooding early on, but soul-searching on climate change, not so much, which was definitely the opposite reaction in Europe. By the way, China has a number of sinking cities, so it has a lot at stake. But the world desperately needs not just words from China, but real concrete cooperation on climate change.
Well, German Chancellor Angela Merkel visited some of the places devastated by recent flooding this week. She also came under pressure to explain why a country as wealthy as Germany was so vulnerable. Here she is speaking on Sunday.
Es ist erschreckend.
It's terrifying. I would say there are no words in the German language to describe this devastation. The lessons are what we know already. We have to hurry. We have to get faster in our fight against climate change.
Nick, how concerned are those you speak to at the State Department and at the Pentagon that the world is not moving fast enough to save us from more of these disasters?
Well, I think in the person of John Kerry, there is great concern. And in general, the Biden administration has tried to elevate the climate discussion, has tried to elevate climate to one of the top priorities when it comes to diplomacy around the world. So we heard John Kerry urging China to take more steps. That is specifically instead of Xi Jinping's promise to allow a peak carbon dioxide emissions by 2030, Kerry says they have to come down earlier than that, and the world simply will fail to meet its goals if it doesn't do that. I think Germany, it's not the U.S. State Department's place to talk about whether it's German hubris or German engineering that caused what we saw in the last week. But certainly this summer of disaster from China, from Germany, in the Pacific Northwest, we saw temperatures that are 1 in 1,000 years. Climate scientists say if we don't hit our climate goals and perhaps even exceed them, that kind of heat dome that we saw well over 100 degrees in places like Seattle and Portland and Vancouver, 100 degrees Fahrenheit, that heat dome would come every 5 to 10 years. So U.S. officials are trying to rally the world to do this, and their target is Glasgow. Their target is COP26, which is in Glasgow later this year in November. And as Kerry puts it, we can save the next 100 years in the next 100 days. But the fact is that it's difficult. All these countries have their own internal resistances, for lack of a better word, to some of these changes. And it's difficult on a good day to get everyone on board, let alone as we're all still coming out of COVID.
Well, while he was in London, John Kerry spoke to the BBC, and he was pushed to address international concerns that before the United States starts telling others what to do about climate change, he has a job to do in his own backyard.
I think people who've lived through this heat dome
We've had people dying because of what is happening now. We have water shortages around the United States. There are enough indicators that people are working through and suffering through, farms that are flooded, crops that don't grow anymore one place or another, that there is now a growing awareness, I am convinced, among people that we have to do something. Now, people don't want to be stupid about it. They want to do things that don't, in fact, undo their lives. And our job is to make sure we offer this up in a way that works for people, and I think we can and are.
Now, we know John Kerry is the lead figure on this issue for the Biden administration, but Paul, how much clout and influence does he have, both abroad and here in the U.S.?
Well, honestly, the problem with John Kerry is he thinks the solution to every problem is basically John Kerry, getting everybody in the room, because his belief in his own powers of persuasion are quite formidable. And he has a bit of a tendency to kind of make very grand statements and leave people, leave the audience that he's trying to convince, feeling slightly lectured. Look, he's a very clever man, and he's obviously very passionate about this topic, and it is really, really a global issue that everybody has to tackle. Is he the right man for the job? When he was in the Middle East as Secretary of State, he really wound up quite a lot of people by sort of talking at them rather than listening. So I don't know is the question. I think, you know, his heart's in the right place. He cares deeply about the subject. It is a very, very pressing subject. And, you know, there is a hope that the meeting in Glasgow will kind of focus minds and move things forward, because every single country on the planet has one way or another got something to lose in all of this. But is Kerry the right man at the right time? I think we're still waiting to see that.
Nick, what reasons does China have for following the U.S. on this issue?
Well, Xi Jinping has said that, you know, he's got a plan that they will have peak carbon dioxide emissions by 2030, carbon neutrality by 2060. Kerry says that just needs to be accelerated. I'm not sure Beijing thinks that it's following the U.S. because, as you pointed out before, the U.S. has its own problems. But I do think that Beijing, Moscow, and Washington, while Washington emphasizes great power competition, John Kerry is right. Others are right when it says that there is a reason to cooperate on climate. And there's frankly a desire to cooperate on China because of Paul hitting the nail on the head. Everyone stands to lose when it comes to this. So, you know, as Paul said, we will see whether the U.S. Can help lead a worldwide consortium with Beijing, especially to try and advance some of these climate issues. You know, one negative perspective perhaps comes out of Germany. You know, I think a lot of the commentators would have assumed that these floods would have caused all the parties there just a couple months before elections to accelerate plans to talk about climate. But that really hasn't happened. I mean, even Armin Laschet, the expected chancellor, while he acknowledged that floods may be related to climate change, he said like a couple hours later, you know, you don't change your policies just because it's a day like this. So we will see whether the world can be rallied by Washington, by Beijing, by other forces. But there's it's a very steep hill to climb. Again, like I said, on a good day, let alone as the world is still trying to come out of COVID.
Well, Ian says this on Twitter, the U.S. can't combat climate change and start a new Cold War against China at the same time. Spheres of influence, scientific segregation, and economic nationalism have irreparably harmed climate change efforts. This week, The Guardian's diplomatic editor wrote that, quote, the world is about to find out if it's possible for one branch of the U.S. federal government, the State Department, to accuse Chinese officials of committing genocide, and for another branch, led by the special envoy on climate change, John Kerry, to persuade China to transform the way its dirty economy operates. How does John Kerry talk his way around that?
Well, either you believe the planet is being cooked to death or it's not. And if it is, then you have to start doing things. And the world cannot get there without the US and China cooperating, as both Paul and Nick have said. China and the US are never going to hold hands. But every government will have to do expensive and unpopular things like closing coal mines and asking people to use more expensive fuel. And for that to work, the Americans and the Chinese have to agree to do some painful things at the same time. If they don't move in sync, one does and the other doesn't, then they'll try and flood the market with cheaper, dirtier energy products. So what Kerry wants is a concrete list. He wants Chinese banks to stop lending money to coal-fired plants outside China, like in Africa. There's been some movement on that front. But let's not pretend. China never agrees to a scenario where America gets to come to China and check whether China is playing by the rules. China's position is the Americans can't expect us to talk about global issues when they're interfering. If you talk about Xinjiang, we won't talk about climate change. And the tragedy is that the world desperately needs cooperation between the US and China. China itself, as I said, has tons of cities that are going to get flooded as sea levels rise. It has every reason to get serious about climate change, but it also wants to grow its economy first, and so it's still building coal plants, but it knows it has to do something. But it's a very difficult balancing act. The point is that they're never going to be best friends.
But Nick, where are some of those key places where we could see cooperation happen? Are there the key issues that the U.S. and China can perhaps connect on?
Well, I think we've been talking about the primary one, climate overall. And again, you know, we do have that target of COP26 later this year that Kerry is certainly and others in the U.S. government are certainly aiming for in terms of galvanizing the world and trying to at least focus people's attention on this while all of our focus is on COVID. Elsewhere, I think U.S. officials will say that China is helpful when it comes to Iran. They have not stood in the way of an Iranian nuclear deal. They haven't sold as much oil to Iran as they have in the past. And so I think U.S. officials are tentatively encouraged by that and hoping that China will be helpful when it comes to Iran in the future. And I think that overall, you know, the U.S. is hoping that China is responsive to some of its pushing, that does not expect Xi Jinping to do anything different when it comes to Xinjiang, Hong Kong, or Taiwan. But when it comes to cyber, when it comes to other issues, the U.S. is certainly hoping that Beijing is willing to cooperate and talk. There is some sign that Beijing is actually listening to that. This weekend, Wendy Sherman, the Deputy Secretary of State, will arrive in China to meet her equivalent, essentially, the foreign minister, who's their number two diplomat. But there was so much conflict just scheduling that meeting over the last few weeks that it does seem to suggest that China is not necessarily on the same page when it comes to high-level dialogue as the U.S. wants it to be.
Well, let's move on to another story. On Thursday, it was announced that the U.S. and Germany had reached an agreement that allowed the completion of a controversial Russian natural gas pipeline called Nord Stream 2, and not everyone was happy.
This deal that they're going to cut with the Germans benefits two people, the rich oligarchs inside of Russia and the wealthy elites in Germany, and no one else. It undermines the Ukrainians, it undermines our friends in Poland, it undermines the United States and NATO. This is absolutely tragic. What they're doing with this Nord Stream 2 pipeline will really undermine American national security.
That was former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo lambasting news of the deal on Fox News this week. Paul, why is this pipeline a big deal?
It's a big deal because it's really, really important for Germany because it needs this gas. And it's a big deal for Russia because it basically means that Russia can pump the gas straight to Germany and then avoid basically the most important country, which is Ukraine, which means that Ukraine doesn't make the money that it used to. So this is about the Germans saying, you know what, we need this for our economy, and the Russians saying they're going to buy it from us, so we're going to take it. But it adds the adds to kind of Russian influence in Europe, and it also punishes a country that's been seen to stand up against Russia and its interference in its affairs, Ukraine. So it's one of those things where, you know, Europe pretends to be together against Russia until self-interest jumps in the pot and that takes over. And that's what's happened here. Germany is all very well kind of joining summits and talking about kind of Russian interference and Russian nasty deeds. But fundamentally, they care most about Germany and the German economy. And so they've put aside some of their reservations and said, sorry, guys, we need to do this.
Hmm. Nick, what do you ultimately think persuaded the Biden administration to ignore some of the strong objections to this, including from within the Democratic Party?
I think before we talk about why the Biden administration chose what it did, it's important to note that the criticism of this does not only come from Mike Pompeo and former Republican senior officials who thought under the Trump administration that they were basically doing a goal line defense and acknowledged that it was 95% complete, but would just basically do whatever it took to try and prevent the proverbial touchdown. This criticism comes from Bob Menendez, Democratic leader of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Many, many Democratic senators were opposed to this. What the Biden administration says is it hears all of that opposition. It understands that Ukraine could stand to lose $3 billion a year in transit fees, that Russia does probably have more leverage over Europe once it pumps so much more energy into Europe, that this does threaten Poland and other friends, as Pompeo pointed out. And yet, the priority for the administration is to, what they say, reestablish or recreate or solidify relationships with Germany. And so they've tried to do this creative method of saying that, well, Germany has leverage right now, so they will convince Russia to extend those $3 billion payments that Russia is currently giving Ukraine. The Biden administration says that this deal will mean Germany will sanction Russia in the future. But there's no automatic movement there. There's no automatic punishment. There's no guarantee that Russia will continue to pay, although they have said that they will to a certain extent after 2024. And what critics of this say is this isn't good enough. And the critics include the Ukrainian government. The Ukrainian foreign minister came out the day after this deal was announced and say, this isn't good enough. And so the criticism will continue. And yet the Biden administration sticking to their guns, their ultimate argument is the U.S.-German relationship is more important than this pipeline.
But Nina, at the same time, another announcement from the White House came out this week, the decision to invite Ukraine's president to come visit. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think Ukraine feels pretty dissed by the U.S. Arguably, this invitation to Washington is later than the Ukrainian president would have liked. There'd been high hopes for the relationship with Biden, but there was another snub last month when President Biden said Ukraine wasn't ready for NATO membership because it had more work to do on cracking down on corruption. I think narrowly on the pipeline, we can expect legal and political challenges from Ukraine. It's made it clear it's not about to stand aside and surrender to Berlin and Washington. And as Paul said, there's an EU dynamic at play. You know, Brussels opposes the pipeline, essentially powerless to block it because it doesn't actually violate any EU law, but is struggling to explain why the US and Germany seem, you know, to feel that they can set energy policy for the entire bloc. And I think as far as Ukraine is concerned, it's battered, bruised. This meeting can't come soon enough. But very bitterly, I think, disappointed in this administration.
Let's catch up on a big investigation revealed by the Washington Post and others this week, which has become known as the Pegasus Project. Nick, what is the Pegasus Project and what have we learned about it?
To me, this is a story about technology that can turn your phone into a spying device and the countries willing to employ it. So the Pegasus Project is a consortium of media companies, as you pointed out, Washington Post is part of that, brought together by Forgotten Stories, a Paris nonprofit with the technical capacity provided by Amnesty International, that investigated software created by an Israeli company, the NSO Group, that turns your phone into, you know, the ultimate spying device. Cameras on, contacts downloaded, messages read. I mean, anything that you do on your phone can be siphoned off. And this is a no-confirmation hack. You know, we're all used to kind of phishing attempts where there's like emails or links that you have to click on. This software does that without, or can infect the phone without the user actually participating. And so countries all over the world have bought this software. The NSO group says that the software is designed to track terrorists and serious criminals. But what this investigation found is that this software is turned against government opponents. It's turned against journalists who are critical of governments. It's turned against opposition politicians themselves whose phones were targeted according to this investigation. It's targeting businessmen whose work interests whoever's in charge in the government. And so what Amnesty and others are saying is that this software is a weapon. And it needs to be regulated. NSO Group needs to turn it off. Israel needs to forbid it from being exported. And countries around the world need to come together to say that we're not going to use this kind of software. There's no signs that any of that is happening. And so this is really a story about how good the technology of spyware has become and how many governments are willing to employ it.
Well, let's move on. On Wednesday, the director of the World Health Organization spoke to the International Olympic Committee ahead of today's opening ceremonies.
The pandemic is a test, and the world is failing. Already this year, the number of deaths is more than double last year's total. In the time it takes me to make these remarks, more than 100 people will lose their lives to COVID-19. And by the time the Olympic flame is extinguished, on the 8th of August, more than 100,000 more people will perish.
Sobering numbers there. Dr. Tedros Adhanom also warned that we are in the early stages of another pandemic and that it's become a two-track pandemic. Nina, what does he mean by that, two-track?
Well, I guess one way to illustrate the gulf between those who have the vaccine and those who don't is by looking at Africa, where the Delta variants pushed COVID to a whole new level. The shortage of vaccines is driving the shocking collapse of Africa's healthcare systems, and the pandemic is killing the unvaccinated in much larger numbers. And also, we've seen lockdowns stoking protests. I mean, vaccine sharing is one huge problem. But broken governments that have been broken a long time are also a big problem. Because of the lack of vaccines, lots of people are having to turn to herbal remedies. There's the question of local vaccine production, even though Pfizer has committed to a production facility in South Africa. The question there is, will there be knowledge transfer, or are they going to leave all of their know-how in Europe? Separately, there's also the problem of vaccine dumping, where people don't actually want or trust foreign vaccines. So South Sudan, for example, most recently, in its first shipment of vaccines, had to dump 60,000 vaccines because they expired. It sent another 60,000 to Kenya because they were unused. And the same thing happened in the DRC. When they redistributed the unused AstraZeneca vaccines, other countries like Nigeria didn't want them because they didn't trust them coming from the DRC. And I think more broadly, governments, you know, clearly now are looking to other countries to see what exit strategies they've got planned. Australia's a case in point. China, where there seems to be zero strategy except for keeping the borders closed. And again, the spectacle of Americans refusing to take the vaccine or having to be persuaded and cajoled is genuinely sickening to people in other parts of the world, literally dying for a lack of vaccine. But yes, vaccine sharing is a huge mess, and we should have it on our global collective conscience. But in talking about lockdowns, vaccines, exit strategies, a lot of it also boils down to your faith in your own government. Take South Africa. Years of corruption, years of negligence, a broken healthcare system. It's not just about vaccine sharing. Governments also need to get their own houses in order. And things that were broken before the pandemic, they have to fix fast. Because you can't carry a population with you in good faith, prepared to lock down, prepared to take vaccines, if you've lost the community's trust.
Well, the pandemic has been especially brutal in Brazil. The country has suffered the second highest number of deaths after the U.S. And a study released this week found that 130,000 Brazilian children have been orphaned during the pandemic. And many place the blame on President Jair Bolsonaro. This week, YouTube removed 15 videos from his channel about the virus. Paul, just explain what's happening there. Why did YouTube take those videos down?
Because he's spreading misinformation about the coronavirus. He's coming up with all sorts of quite remarkable ideas, I guess is a polite way of putting it, talking about herbal remedies being the solution. He's been a COVID skeptic all the way through, so he's still been pushing things like hydroxychloroquine and anti-parasitic drugs. And I think basically he has been seen in Brazil as someone who right from the beginning has not taken this pandemic seriously. He got it himself, didn't change the way that he thought about it. Brazil is another country that has a really, really fragile healthcare system, which is under stress and is in parts collapsing. And so, you know, YouTube has looked at what he said, looked at his channel and said, well, you know, we need to do something about this. Otherwise, people are going to start blaming us. So they've taken down videos that have been reposted or stuff that he said, because they're just saying it's causing basically people's deaths because it's disinforming them about what's going on.
You know, Nick, we spoke about misinformation in Facebook earlier this week on the show, and we recently spoke to the head of the International Rescue Committee who was blunt about the fact that vaccine misinformation has become their number one problem. Is playing whack-a-mole the best we can do at this point?
Well, I think that playing whack-a-mole is probably what most critics would say we are doing at this point. You know, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter obviously has been receiving most of the ire of whether it's President Biden, who accused Facebook of murdering people, he later walked that back, or whether it's criticism of YouTube for not acting fast enough, or Twitter. And as Paul said, you know, there are very prominent deniers, very prominent people like, you know, Jair Bolsonaro, who are claiming there are still miracle cures, who are still claiming that it's not serious, who are still ridiculing people for wearing masks or social distancing at the very moment that Delta is on the rise. And so I think what most, you know, critics of the social media companies or our approach in general would say is we are playing whack-a-mole. But it's also difficult to create some kind of global framework when there's so much disagreement, even a national framework, when so many of the means through which disinformation is disseminated are private companies.
Well, there's still a lot of moving parts as the world grapples with the pandemic. Italy is now requiring that you test negative for COVID-19 for many social activities. England is struggling with a pingdemic caused by an app that tells you if you've come into contact with someone who's tested positive. We talked about that earlier this week. And on Thursday, a Chinese official said the government there would not agree to a follow-up investigation by the World Health Organization. That official said the so-called lab leak theory is, quote, a rumor. Paul, briefly, give us a bigger picture here. What's going on?
Well, look, there was a WHO investigation in January, and they put their report out in March. And frankly, it was pretty much rubbished by everyone apart from China, because it basically, you know, was seen to have been far too willing to take China's position on pretty much almost everything. So the WHO has said, you know, we need to do a follow-up on this. They're trying to put a brave face on it by saying the first report suggested more areas for study, so let's go into them. The Chinese are saying absolutely not. You know, they're just not prepared to accept any responsibility for what happened with COVID. They're basically saying it's entirely a natural event, nothing to do with them, couldn't have been stopped. So that's where it ends. And the rest of the world is saying, well, you haven't really answered the questions. You haven't given us the access that we need to be able to prove that that's the case. And more importantly, they're saying if we don't work out what happened this time, we could all end up making the same mistake again. But this is all wrapped up in Chinese nationalism. They're not prepared to let anybody else wander around China investigating how they run their affairs. And I honestly can't see this getting very far. It's another one of those things where China's on one side and much of the rest of the world is on the other. And there really are no means of making the Chinese do what they don't want to do.
Well, let's turn to another part of the world and a story we've been following for the last couple of weeks. The funeral is taking place today for the recently assassinated president of Haiti, Jovenel Moïse. The former Prime Minister Claude Joseph took control of the country shortly after the killing, but handed it over to Ariel Henry this week. Nina Maria, why the change in leadership?
Well, it's been a spectacularly difficult time for Haiti over the past year, and the complexities I will leave to Nick. But just in terms of the US's kind of narrow ability to influence the outcome in Haiti, because the US has come under a lot of criticism, this administration, in terms of its response amid calls for the US to intervene, I think that there are some concrete ways for the U.S. to help Haiti, and Haiti's fleeing Haiti. Certainly, we're seeing the Biden administration turning away Haitian refugees at the border, threatening many with repatriation. They're basically shut out of the southern border, and those numbers are going up and will go up. The White House has given, I think, 100,000 Haitians who arrived in the U.S. before May temporary protected status. But I don't think that's going to help any Haitians fleeing now, and certainly not by sea. So I think human rights organizations are basically calling on the U.S. to offer legal routes for Haitians to come to the U.S. But in terms of the internal dynamics of Haitian politics, I defer to my more experienced panelists.
Well, and Nick, I'll come to you here. What do we know about Ariel Henry and what this move in leadership means for the stability of Haiti's government?
So Henri is a neurosurgeon and a politician, and this is a political truce. You know, Claude Joseph, as you said, who was scheduled to be replaced the week of the assassination, he had held on to power. He is now stepping down. Joseph Lambert, the head of the Senate, he had been trying to achieve power and says that he stopped because of U.S. pressure. And so that leaves Henri, who was supposed to become prime minister the week of the assassination, as leading this country. And, you know, he says that this is a new chapter. He says that this is a sign that Haiti's politicians, who have been maligned for so long, can make the country better, can improve people's lives. But, you know, as we all know, the list of challenges are immense. The list is immense, rather. Not only corruption and impunity for so many of Haiti's powerful. Inequality between the rich and the poor is among the world's worst. Violence, crime, kidnapping, gangs, insecurity, these are the words on every Haitian's lips. You know, gangs are brazen. They control parts of the capital. They attack at will. They kidnap children. They kidnap pastors in the middle of services. And a real political atrophy. And that was especially from Jovenel Moïse's in the last couple years. You have only 10 of 30 senators. You have a lower house entirely vacant. He was governing by decree. And so what the U.S. wants is new elections. And Ariel Henry's job is to figure out how to get there and how to make sure that there's not more violence in the next few months.
Well, that's what the U.S. wants. What do the Haitian people want when it comes to international intervention?
Less of it and relief for the inequities in their life. You know, it became very clear, I guess it was last weekend, that Henri was the man who the U.S. and what's known as the core group of diplomats from all over the world, they released a letter that referred to Henri as Haiti's next leader and did not refer at all to Claude Joseph, the now former prime minister. And so what that revealed was American and international intervention in Haiti, which has a very long history and generally has ended very poorly. And so what people in Haiti, what civil society leaders in Haiti decried again was the U.S. choosing their leader. But the bottom line is that outcome, the inequities, the violence, the corruption, that is what Haitians want to see tackled. Henri says that he can do it. You know, the U.S. is hoping that an election can make things better, but these are entrenched problems that will be very difficult, and frankly, they're generational.
One other big headline out of the Caribbean this week, the Biden administration transferred a Moroccan man out of Guantanamo Bay and sent him home. And this is the first release from Guantanamo since 2016. Abdul Latif Nasser was never charged with a crime. Nick, what's his story?
So he was, as you just said, that's the headline, never charged with a crime after 19 years, picked up in Afghanistan, believed to be a member of the Taliban, and he's Moroccan. And so he gets transferred. And he was earmarked, I guess, is for lack of a better word, by a parole review board to be transferred in 2016. But it was never done under the Obama administration, and the Trump administration largely stopped transfers. There was only one during the Trump administration. And so what we have is President Biden saying that he wants to go back to President Obama's policy on Guantanamo, but we'll all recall that President Obama vowed to close Gitmo, and here we are still talking about it. There are 39 prisoners left. 10 are eligible for transfer. 17 are eligible for a review board. And so that's the number that they're looking at. The other 12, two have been convicted, 10 involved in military commissions already. So, you know, the problem of Guantanamo is one that President Biden and his administration say they want to tackle. They say they want to get those 10 who are eligible today and the 17 who are eligible for review off out of Guantanamo as quickly and as safely as they can. But there remains certainly domestic political opposition, and the logistics of convincing governments around the world, the diplomacy required to convince governments around the world to take these men, and the politics of what they do after continues to really be a challenge and really slow down the desire to close Guantanamo.
Well, let's close out the hour with some music and a trip to a city that the UN once ranked alongside Venice, Machu Picchu, and Yosemite National Park. It's a place famous for a lot of reasons, and of course, it's home to these Fab Four.
I'm a loser. I'm a loser. And I'm not what I appear to be.
This week, Liverpool, home to the Beatles, lost out again, becoming only the third site in history to have its designation as a World Heritage Site revoked by UNESCO. Nina, what happened?
Well, I'm really ashamed to say that I've never been to Liverpool. And when I do go, I'll be very sorry it's no longer a World Heritage Site. This decision was made by a secret UNESCO ballot in China. It's really understandably upset people. Lots of reaction over it being a day of shame for Liverpool. What strikes me as really odd is that there wasn't much earlier consultation going on between Liverpool and UNESCO over its controversial waterfront development, which triggered this decision. I would have thought that if you've got this incredibly prestigious status, that there are conditions attached and a kind of early warning system, like don't build that development because it's going to compromise your status, your UNESCO status. So a bit of a humiliating out of the blue announcement. And yeah, very, very sad to hear it.
Paul, what does it mean to be a World Heritage Site?
Well, it gives you status. It makes people want to turn up and look at your city. I mean, the competing issues in Liverpool is that they're trying to redevelop the main waterfront area, which is kind of very tied up in the kind of global history of trade and the UK's history as an empire. But at the same time, it's an underdeveloped area, and it's, you know, it's in need of renovation. And what the locals are saying is, well, hang about, you're taking this away from us because we're trying to improve people's lives, and that's unfair. The UNESCO is saying, actually, you're going about it in a ham-fisted way and knocking down things you should be looking after. So the argument in Liverpool is, we don't understand this decision. We are looking after the buildings that you say are very important, but we are trying to renovate an area and improve the lives of people living in Liverpool now, rather than just hang on to what used to be there hundreds of years ago. But, you know, at the end of the day, Liverpool is, you know, I've been to Liverpool, and it's quite a good city. It's a very vibrant city. And I think they'll take it on the chin. At the end of the day, I suspect most people didn't really go all the way up to Liverpool because it was a UNESCO site to look at the docks. It's more about the kind of cultural history of the city. You know, the Beatles and everybody who came out of it, the football. So I suspect that Liverpool will survive.
Well, we'll let the Liverpudlians have the last word here. Here's some of them speaking to the BBC.
I think it will show to people maybe a side of UNESCO that they feel quite disappointed in. And when they come to the city, they will think, how was UNESCO not appreciating what Liverpool are doing?
And I think we stand out from the crowd anyway, and we'll survive. We always do.
Well, perhaps at some point we should all take a trip to Liverpool together. That's it for the News Roundup. With us today, Paul Danahar, Washington Bureau Chief for the BBC and author of The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring, Nina Maria Potts, Director of Global News Coverage for Feature Story News, and Nick Schifrin, Foreign Affairs and Defense Correspondent with the PBS NewsHour. Nick, Nina Maria, Paul, thanks so much for joining us. 1A's senior producer is Jacqueline Hill. Paige Osborne is our managing producer. Barb Anguiano produces our podcast, and Mike Kidd engineered the show this week. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and we will talk again soon. This is 1A.